Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
The people of the Commonwealth like what we do, and they like how we do it.
I'm out there every single day in the middle of a huge fight.
The Boston economy is doing quite well. We're seeing a lot of commercial real estate going up in Boston.
This jersey, it doesn't say Red Sox. It says Boston.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Barone, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
I'm Tom Maroney.
And I'm Joe Shortsley.
You know, as we went on the air here, we're going to tell you what the program's all about in a moment. But Kim Kerrigan, you have some breaking news.
I do. Now, this is coming from CNN. This has just come across my phone. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is telling friends and allies in phone calls on Wednesday that he has made a decision to run for president.
Wow.
Two people familiar with the matter are saying at this hour.
You know, we had Scott Furson, the Democratic strategist, on the phone here on the program yesterday, and he seemed to suggest that he thought he would. He didn't know he would.
Yeah,
that's
a fair
assessment. But he
thought
he would, but that's interesting because he canceled his speaking engagement in
Colorado
today.
Colorado Springs, right.
Right.
He
wow.
was he had been scheduled there for quite some time.
He steps a little closer, and we have no idea, no real clear information on when he might make the announcement, but as Kim just said, CNN reporting he has made that decision according to sources. So we will certainly continue to follow that in this program tonight as well. On the day the House impeachment hearings go public, President Trump hosts Turkey's Erdogan in the White House. We'll hear some of that live in the 3 o'clock hour. Plus, another political note, Senator Elizabeth Warren files for the New Hampshire primary today. We'll have a live report from our Bloomberg reporter in the state capital of Concord.
Yeah, and our 5 o'clock hour, we have a special guest. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins will be here for the whole hour. Since winning 80% of the vote a year ago, she's really been a lightning rod for controversy for her decision not to prosecute some low-level crimes, a decision she vehemently defends. But we invited her here today really to talk about the Carol Stewart murder 30 years ago last month. Of course, she was murdered by her husband, Chuck. He accused a black man of the murder. Rollins will be here to talk about the racial scars that murder left on the city and her office and the lessons learned. But first, breaking news that CNN is reporting at this point that former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick will announce tomorrow on social media that he is indeed running for president. And then, of course, they are also reporting that he will be in New Hampshire on Friday, which makes sense because it's the last day to file for the New Hampshire primary.
Right. And speaking of New Hampshire, we're going to go to live to the state capitol in Concord. Our Bloomberg reporter, Ms. Lena Egolfapulu, is there. She was on our program yesterday here in studio, but she traveled north to witness Senator Elizabeth Warren actually filing for the New Hampshire primary a couple days ahead of the deadline. Ms. Lena, welcome back to the program. A chilly day in Concord, no doubt.
A very chilly day. I'm currently holding on to hand warmers as I try to make it through the day. But thank you for having me on again.
Yeah, set the scene for us. Has Warren actually filed at this point?
Warren has filed. She is officially a candidate in the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary election. She walked into the state house a little after 1 p.m. earlier today and was greeted by some hundreds of supporters who had joined her in the state house to witness her signing the paperwork that's necessary for her to enter the ballot. There were chants that were going on that sounded something like, Liz is good, Liz is great, she's fighting for the Granite State. And so there was a lot of energy. There was a lot of energy in the state house, a lot of pictures. Following the filing, she exited the state house and held a short rally in which she again reiterated her plans for some big structural changes in the current American system and sort of noted that, you know, that's what's necessary moving forward. If the Democrats want to win this election. And then, of course, she ended, as she does every event, by hanging around and making sure she takes selfies with every single person that showed up at the event.
So she's still doing that?
She's currently still doing that.
Ms. Rolanda, she does that to the last person in line, right?
The very last person in line, until the very last person who works at any of that venue that she might show up in. She's very sort of giving with her time when it comes to that. It's a big part of her campaign. She did spend some time, however, also talking to reporters, and the the issue of Deval Patrick sort of entering the race along with Michael Bloomberg came up. And I know you guys have been covering this. It's just breaking now that he's announcing, you know, his candidacy sometime before this week ends, which would give him just enough time to make the Friday deadline, like you mentioned. And Elizabeth Warren had something to say about that. She sort of scorned billionaires one more time for feeling the need to sort of go out of their way to stop her from, or any other candidate at this point in the race, from trying to win the nomination. And she said, you know, I'm going to quote just exactly what she said. She said, other billionaires encourage their billionaire buddies to jump into the race, but I believe that what our election should be is about grassroots movement, and it really shouldn't be about having billionaires calling all the shots. And so, you know, she rarely criticizes her rivals, but this, I think, is a sort of a direct reaction to how she feels about the possibility of either of them entering the race at this point.
Yeah, we're talking with a Bloomberg political reporter, Ms. Relena Igalfapulu, who is covering the Warren campaign and has been covering the Warren campaign since last May very closely. She's currently in Concord, New Hampshire, where Elizabeth Warren filed paperwork today for the New Hampshire primary. I also just want to mention to our listeners out there that we're standing by for live coverage of President Trump's press conference with the president of Turkey. And if we have to interrupt, we will. But, Ms. Relena, if you could, what you just said there about Elizabeth Warren. So she basically referred to Deval Patrick entering the race as somebody's billionaire buddy.
I mean, look, she's a candidate that's really refrained from criticizing any of her rivals and saying names. She will not go down that route. But I mean, she is very clear about how she feels when it comes to billionaires coming into the race and trying to change the course. And so I feel like it wasn't about him, but it really also sort of was about him. This is just how she feels. I think about billionaires, and he is one of them.
Well, it's in stark contrast to Biden and others who give this the more the merrier vibe. You didn't hear any of that today, I suppose.
No, I mean, I think for her, it's not an issue of you know, the more the merrier. I think for her, it's more of an issue of who's the person that's sort of going after this nomination. And for her, I mean, she's being very consistent throughout her entire campaigning. It should not be you know, people with who are using their money to influence politics in any way. I think she's been clearer about that all along, and I think she will be clear about this if they do decide to actually join the race.
Yeah, well, there was some conversation, Ms. Relena, about how these two, if in fact Deval got in, and it looks like now he's going to announce that he is getting in, how these two would interact, given that he is a former governor and she's the U.S. senator from Massachusetts, and they were expecting some decorum between the
well,
two.
Well,
they're
rather chummy. They've shared consultants. They've shared other things, and apparently that detente is gone.
Yeah, but to call him a billionaire buddy, that's pretty good. Warren's schedule. What is Warren's schedule going forward here?
So we have. So the senator will be visiting a child care center later today here in Concord, and will be ending her day in Concord with a town hall, and then she's off to I'm not sure actually where she's going to be tomorrow and Friday, but off to Iowa and Nevada this weekend, to other very crucial states. And so she's finishing the day here in New Hampshire. We will be with her throughout those, and we'll keep you updated with anything that comes in.
Yeah, all right.
But again, those comments that she made about other candidates, specifically as it relates to Deval Patrick, were prior to the breaking news about him definitely entering the race. It was more just a reference to the possibility of him entering the race.
Right. Mm-hmm. She was actually asked whether she thinks they're you know, thinking to enter the race means that, you know, they're trying to basically stop someone like her from passing, mm-hmm. say, a Medicare for All plan or a wealth tax, whether she feels that, you know, they're seeing a need to sort of jump in and interfere is because of what she's proposing. And she was clear. She said that she doesn't want to comment or criticize any of those two, but she said that, you know, billionaires are not the solution to the problems that America faces nowadays.
All right. Ms. Rolena Egolfopoulou, we much appreciate your report live from Concord, New Hampshire, on this day that Elizabeth Warren has filed for the New Hampshire primary.
Janet Wu is now joining us live in the studio here as well. She had a chance to sit down with Steve Grossman. He, of course, is a former state treasurer, but also head of the state Democratic Party. And, Janet, you got a chance to talk to him about Deval Patrick and his presidential aspirations.
Yeah, so Steve was at an event this morning that he is now CEO of. It's the Initiative for the Competitive Inner City. And, of course, this is what everyone is talking about. And since he's had such a robust political life here, as you were saying, former chairman of the state Democratic Party, he also served as our state treasurer and was himself a candidate for governor and a good friend of Deval. And he served with Deval Patrick. So I asked him about this. I asked about the crowded field of Democratic candidates. I asked him about his conversations with Deval. And I also asked about the perception that right now the campaign is somewhat chaotic.
Look, people say it's chaotic, but let's remember that when the Republicans had their primary battle back in 2016, they had 17 candidates, and everybody thought it was going to be chaotic, and they didn't know how it was going to turn out. I mean, it didn't turn out so badly for the Republicans. They found up they wound up with the nominee, and the nominee, Donald Trump, won. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what you think about the president, a chaotic, tumultuous primary season brings more activists into the process, brings more first-time voters in, brings more younger activists in. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a battle about health care and a battle about a lot of things, and should these candidates like Bloomberg and Deval Patrick get in late in the campaign? I think that if a candidate wants to get in, she or he has to run the gauntlet. I'm pleased and proud, of course, that my candidate, Pete Buttigieg, is doing so well in Iowa and New Hampshire, but I am not one of these people who wrings his hands and suggests that this kind of chaos can only result in defeat. I think it actually inspires more people to get involved. And if you do it in all 50 states, come the election, Democrats need big turnout to win. And if we can get big turnout, particularly among diverse voting groups, African Americans and Latino voters who tended to stay home back in 2016, that wasn't good for us. And I think this will inspire more participation, more activism, and more energy. So it doesn't bother me in the least. Candidates want to get in. That's what democracy is all about.
But you are friends with Deval. You've worked with him. Will this change who you support
if
he comes in?
No, I'm with Pete Buttigieg. I spoke with Deval a year and a half ago about this. And I said, Deval, if you run for president of the United States, I want to be with you. And he decided not to run. He can decide to change his mind, but people like me are deeply committed to another candidate, and I believe Pete Buttigieg will be the next president of the United States. I'm going to do everything I can for him. But I respect Deval for everything he's done. I worked with him very closely when he was governor and I was state treasurer. He has a great story to tell. He is an inspirational speaker. He will excite and energize people in ways that we've heard many times before in his two terms as governor. So for those who suggest that Deval shouldn't get in, it's too late, he doesn't have much to add to the process, if Deval decides to run, I wish him well, but I'm with Pete all the way.
Do you think it is a done deal that Deval will indeed run?
I have no idea. I haven't spoken with him in the last couple of weeks. I spoke to Diane Patrick recently. We didn't come up in the conversation. So I have no idea what his ultimate decision is going to be, but I wish him well. As I say, I'm with Pete.
Overall, you are optimistic about the upcoming election.
Oh, I am. Because I think Democrats are standing with and for the American people and the things that matter most in their lives. And I think Donald Trump is banking on chaos in the Democratic Party. And I think when we come together around a nominee and the Democratic Party, the best unifier in the Democratic Party is Donald Trump. He unifies Democrats in a way that probably might not have otherwise happened, because you've got the whole ideological spectrum represented, from Bernie Sanders on one end to more moderate candidates on the other end. But Donald Trump brings people together because Democrats want Donald Trump to be a one-term president. They will do everything they can to make him a one-term president.
But we've also heard a lot of Democrats saying that they express doubt in the current field of candidates, Democratic candidates, to defeat Donald Trump.
Democrats worry about everything. I mean, the idea that Pete Buttigieg, my candidate, a 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a married gay man, can be Democratic nominee and be president of the United States, people find very difficult to get their heads around. For me, if you listen to Pete Buttigieg on TV, on radio, in fora all over the country, he has made great common sense. He's down to earth. He's common sense. He's humble. He's a Midwesterner. We need to do well in the Midwest. So I think that people tend to worry about things because, oh, my God, we don't have the savior of the Democratic Party. I don't look at it that way. When we have a nominee standing on that stage in Milwaukee accepting the nomination of the Democratic Party, he or she will unify the Democratic Party, and I will be behind the nominee every step of the way, all the way to November.
I thought it was very interesting, guys, that Steve revealed that he had a conversation specifically about a presidential run with Deval a year and a half ago. At that time, he pledged his support and said if he put his hat in the ring, he would be his main supporter. But Deval at that point said no, and Steve then committed to another candidate, and he's going to stick with that candidate. Mm-hmm. He drew a pattern that initially you support the party, then you have to choose a candidate, and then it's going to come back again where you support the party. If you recall, Steve was the chair of the Democratic National Committee from 97 to 99. Again, I caught him up with him today at the Initiative for a Competitive Inner City, which is holding its convention at the Heinz.
All right, Janet, thank you very much. We're going to stay with this. But before we get to that, Michael Bloomberg, we want to remind people, founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg News. Bloomberg has not made a formal decision on whether he will run for president at this time.
I'm remembering the conversation we had just a few moments ago with our Bloomberg political reporter, Ms. Relena Igalfapulu, and she was up there as Elizabeth Warren is filling up paperwork for the New Hampshire primary, and she said that she was referencing people getting into the race, and she referred to the other people and their billionaire buddies. Now, it wasn't a specific reference to Deval Patrick,
no.
But it was clear.
It was close.
It was very close. that's an indication of which way this is going.
Well, yeah, I think what I found interesting in regard to that is that she said Senator Warren has refrained from any of that kind of talk. I mean, not even close to a personal attack. No mention of the other people. I think Joe Biden, one of the latest ones got in, said the more the merrier. So that's a completely different spirit. Warren has remained neutral until today, apparently, when she took a shot at the latecomers to the race. And maybe there are more to come.
I want to remind our listeners that we are standing by for live coverage of President Trump's press conference at the White House with the president of Turkey. And as soon as he does begin to speak, we will bring that to you live in its entirety. But coming back to the topic at hand, and of course, the Globe is now also reporting what CNN was reporting, and that is that Deval Patrick will make his announcement official tomorrow, apparently on social media, and then he'll be in New Hampshire on Friday as well. And I'm reminded of our conversation that we had yesterday with Scott Ferson, a Democratic strategist in the state of Massachusetts. And you asked the question, Tom. You were talking about, okay, Deval doesn't have the personal wealth that these other candidates have, so where's the money coming from?
Right.
And Scott Ferson basically just right away said Obama's connection. And
well, the connection, yeah. He didn't mean Obama's going to write the checks, but, yeah, that the Obama wing, such as it is, of the Democratic Party. And we both, at this point in time, at any point, really, it's about the money. But at this late stage, it's really about the money. It's no longer as much about raising as what do you got now? And we looked at this Reason to Believe PAC that was formed by Deval's former chief of staff, Doug Rubin. There's less than $1 million in there. And even those are outdated figures. So perhaps even a much significantly lower amount than that. So come on. Where is this coming from? There has to be a benefactor or two out there. We were surmising yesterday, perhaps given the reporting that Wall Street is unhappy or even afraid that Warren will get the nod, backing somebody like Patrick, who has this corporate background, Coca-Cola, Texaco, Bain Capital now, where he hangs his hat. But all speculation at this point. It's still, to most people, including Dante Scala, who's a political scientist at UNH, we had him on the air yesterday, this is a head scratcher.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that Wall Street is concerned about Elizabeth Warren's bid. Was it Jamie Dimon who was on 60 Minutes Sunday night basically said so? Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, you know, you look at someone who is you know, Deval Patrick is a very sharp, cunning politician. He knows what he's up against if he's going to try to make any sort of difference here. And he would have to have gotten some sort of assurance from somebody don't worry about the money.
Let me interject this. I was talking to a gentleman today who's very active in politics. He has a job, but, you know, he belongs to this force multiplier group, and they try to look for candidates across the country, Democrats. And he was talking about Warren, and he said, you know, in conversations with other people, the thing that stands out is that this Medicare for All, even for the most liberal in the Democratic Party, for many of them, it looks like a bridge too far. You are overturning a system that for many people works just fine. They have a good or great health care plan. Mm-hmm. And she is saying, forget about all that. We're going to have the government run this. And we've said this before, Buttigieg is gaining some traction now, and I think it's partly because of that. And so here comes Deval Patrick. He's not we don't know for sure yet, but I'm surmising he's not a Medicare for All guy. And so maybe that's what's, you know, I think that's part of what's happening.
Well, that's basically, again, not to relive exactly our interview with Scott Fersen yesterday, but that's exactly what he said. It seems to be that this Medicare for All and the large numbers associated with it and Elizabeth Warren's explanation of how she'd pay for it has, you know, frightened a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it is too much of a seismic change at this point.
All right. Well, 30 years after the Charles Stewart case, Boston is still healing. That's the headline of a recent Commonwealth Magazine story about the district attorney's office involvement in wrongdoing back in 1989. It's been 30 years, can you believe it, since the murder case that shook Boston to the core.
Yeah, Charles Stewart shot his pregnant wife and himself after leaving a childbirth class at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Stewart blamed the fatal attack on a black man, and police identified two innocent men as suspects. Last week, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins convened a panel discussion and community conversation at Northeastern University to explore the issues raised by the case. We'll talk to Rachel Rollins live in our Boston studio in just a few moments. But first, Bloomberg's Ann Mostu has a review of the case.
Most of us who were living in Boston in 1989 remember this 911 call played over and over on the news.
State Police Boston, record emergency 510.
My wife's been shot. I've been shot.
The call came into a state police dispatcher at around 8:30 p.m. on October 23rd, 1989.
Okay, has your wife been shot as well?
Yes.
Massachusetts State Police spent almost 15 minutes trying to find Charles Stewart and his pregnant wife in their car in Boston's Mission Hill neighborhood. Charles Stewart had shot his wife in the head and himself in the stomach.
Stop breathing.
All right, Chuck, I'm going to get assistance to you, buddy. Open the door.
Carol DeMady Stewart was rushed back to Brigham and Women's. Doctors delivered her baby boy 2 months early. She and the baby only lived a matter of days. On October 28th, Carol was buried in Medford. More than 800 people, including Boston Mayor Ray Flynn and Governor Michael Dukakis, attended her funeral. Charles Stewart was at Boston City Hospital, but he wrote a eulogy that was read during Carol's service. In it, he encouraged forgiveness of the killer. Mayor Flynn and other politicians rallied around Charles Stewart.
I was at the hospital tonight, and the priest was there saying a prayer, and it breaks your heart to see this kind of situation.
Charles Stewart maintained that he and his wife were shot by a black male who stopped the couple as they left their childbirth class. More than 100 additional officers were assigned to scour Mission Hill, Roxbury, and Mattapan, searching for anyone who fit the vague description Stewart gave of an attacker. Police arrested a man named Willie Bennett. Several lawmakers immediately demanded Massachusetts reinstate the death penalty. Then, in a stunning turnaround, Charles Stewart's brother, Matthew Stewart, came forward and told police his brother staged the crime to collect insurance money. Now the prime suspect, with evidence showing he had planned his wife's murder for months, Charles Stewart committed suicide by jumping off the Tobin Bridge on January 4, 1990. Matthew Stewart served 5 years after admitting to police that he took Charles's gun and threw it off a bridge in Revere. Even that was controversial. Here's his attorney, Nancy Gertner, back in 1990.
Had Charles Stewart lived, there is no doubt, there can be no doubt, but that Matthew Stewart would never, ever have been prosecuted. When Charles Stewart took his own life, the only thing that changed was the political pressure to do something.
John McMahon, a friend who helped Matthew Stewart dispose of evidence, was also convicted on obstruction charges. Newman Flanagan, Suffolk County District Attorney, indicated that he was satisfied.
This apparently completes the investigation into the deaths of Carol Stewart and her son.
And the news media's use of graphic photos and videotape from the scene of the brutal murder raised questions about how the press covers such events. An overwhelming sense of vengeance had swept the community. Harvard Law School and the Boston Association of Black Journalists held a panel on February 13, 1990, on media coverage of the Stewart murder case. Here's Stan Hopkins, the former news director at WBZ.
We as a television station basically reacted to that story as we would any other story. And the growing public interest in that story from all sources, also a sense of growing apprehension, if you will, and paranoia that was growing at the time. I recall not going anywhere without someone raising the question as to, is it safe to go into the city of Boston?
Aside from the shock of Charles Stewart's lies, the violent deaths, and how the press and officials were so easily swayed by Stewart's story, there was lasting racial tension. Mayor Flynn apologized to the Bennett family, telling Mrs. Bennett, quote, "What has taken place has been very unfortunate," end quote. The Bennett family said he stayed for only a couple of minutes and wouldn't sit down when offered a seat. When pressed about his role, Mayor Flynn told the Globe in January 1990, quote, "Everybody owes an apology to the Mission Hill neighborhood, to the black community, and they all owe an apology to the people of the city. We should all stand in line waiting for that apology," end quote. Willie Bennett unsuccessfully sued the Boston Police Department, claiming that officers violated his civil rights. Anne Mostu, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 92.9 HD2.
Yeah, Tom, my story, and very nice job there by Anne Mostu recounting the facts of that day. At the time, I was a young reporter at Channel 56, the 10 o'clock news with Jack Hines. And, of course, this story was the story of the decade for the city of Boston. And everybody was trying to speak with family members about what had happened here. And basically, Carol DeMatey Stewart had one brother, Carl DeMatey. And he was the person that so many people wanted to talk to, and he never spoke. I found out where he lived, and I would occasionally, at the end of my day, my reporter's day at Channel 56, would swing by the address and ring the doorbell and see if he was around. And a little bit of a side note here. I'm a local kid. I went to BC High in Dorchester, and I used to live in Newton. I used to take the Green Line every day to the Red Line and change and go out to what was then Columbia Point, now JFK. So one day I decided to swing by Carl DeMatey Stewart's house, and I'm standing there, and I'm there with my photographer, Brian Sullivan. And you have two options in a situation like that. You know, you can, as we like to say, you know, just spray the person with the camera as they approach you. And I said to Brian, I remember saying, "Brian, no, put it down. Put the camera down." And Carl DeMatey walked up to me. I introduced myself. I said, "I'm Joe Shortsleeve. I work at Channel 56. And he said, "Joe, I know who you are. You went to BC High. I'll talk to you." And I'd sat there and I said, "Okay, 4 years on the Green Line just paid off." And, I did an 11-minute interview with Carl DeMatey. The things I remember most about it is he said to me, he said, "I never, ever, ever suspected Chuck Stewart of this crime. I never, ever did. There was no indication. He didn't behave that way." So I went back to the television station, and the news director at the time was Jack Fitzgerald. And I was in television, you always think in, you know, in terms of 2 minutes or 3 minutes to prepare a report. I was in the edit room, and he came in and he said, "Can you play it for me?" And it was like 11 minutes long. And he said, "You know what we're going to do, Joe? We're going to play the whole interview. We're going to play all 11 minutes. And I can remember going, "Wow, okay." News had gotten out that Carl DeMatey had spoken to me. The other television stations were calling, channels 4, 5, 7 at the time, which was the other NBC affiliate in Boston. And it was pretty unusual for them to it had never happened, but they basically asked for my story. They all aired it that night on the 11 o'clock news in Boston. We aired it at 10 o'clock. They aired it at 11 o'clock news. And it was a very rare event for a reporter to be caught up in that situation where you were on all four stations. Long story short, Channel 4 asked me to be on People Are Talking with Tom Bergeron. As I walked off the set, I was introduced to Stan Hopkins, who was in Ann's story, speaking from WBZ. They hired me, and I spent 25 years at Channel 4.
It was a big
impact on my life. I'll never forget it. And very sad because my son is 30 years old, and that's how old Christopher DeMady Stewart would be. And it's hard.
It's emotional. And Ann Mostu, you have a bit of a story here. You were very young.
I was 8 years old, and my mother was so moved by the story that she took me to Carol DeMady Stewart's funeral. And I remember being there and thinking it was really sad. Yeah. And also wondering a little bit why my mother had taken me there. My parents were really into the news. Yeah. And but my mother was really moved by this case and very, very sad for this woman. Yeah. And I remember we lived in Somerville at the time, and we drove over to Medford and went to the funeral.
800 people, as you say.
Yeah, at St. James.
The Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins is in our studio. I just want to say a quick hello.
Hello.
District Attorney, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Yeah, of course. The reason Tom and I invited her here today, it has to do with the 30th anniversary of the Carol Stewart murder in Boston. It was something that was very somewhat personal and professional to me. I reached out to Carol DeMady and was able to get an interview with him, which was a story which changed the trajectory of my career. But I also have a son who's 30 years old today, and that's how old Christopher DeMady Stewart would be. So I know I don't know the feeling of that loss, but I can only imagine what it's like for the family. But to recap just the story a little bit, it happened on October 23rd, 1989?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, of course, Chuck Stewart shot his wife and then shot himself. He blamed the murder on a black man. The city, as Ann Mostu reported, they added 100 police officers. They swept over Mission Hill. They arrested two black men, Alan Swanson and Willie Bennett. But quickly the story began to fall apart. It became clear that Chuck Stewart, along with his brother Matthew, had somehow planned this murder and then did their best to cover it up. Chuck Stewart jumped off the Tobin Bridge on January 4th, 1990. Since then, the city of Boston has been asking these questions. You know, how did we get so duped? How is it possible that we did what we did? And I was just looking at the Herald headline, "Gunman invades car." Mm-hmm. No, he didn't. We all believed the story. We all took him at his word, and we were more than willing to believe his story and blame it on a black man in Mission Hill. This past week, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, on the 30th anniversary, convened a panel over at Northeastern to look at these questions, to examine the racial scars that this particular horrific murder has left on the city. So, Rachel, if you could, there's also an article that you wrote in Commonwealth Magazine, 30 years after the Stewart case, Boston's still reeling. And at the end of it, you say, as you open up this panel at Northeastern, "That's why today I'm here to say I'm sorry, especially to the Bennett family, because the truth is the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office was complicit and what happened 30 years ago." Tell us about that.
Yeah, I remember, Joe, like it was yesterday. I had just graduated from high school and was up at college at UMass Amherst. And even 2 hours away, I remember my mom talking to her brothers, who all lived in the Boston area, some of them in the Mission Hill area, about what was happening in that moment. I think why it was so important to me that I wrote about this and convened a panel is Christopher and Carol get lost in this story. This is a domestic violence homicide. October was Domestic Violence Month, and I didn't want that lost in there. I didn't want Carol DeMady to be lost. She was a lawyer. She was a vibrant person. Christopher lived for 17 days. She was brutally murdered by her husband after leaving a birthing class at Brigham and Women's, and then was returned back to the very place she had just left in such a joyful state, having gone to this class with her allegedly loving husband to give birth to her son and die a day later. And then Christopher was gone. And I sort of what was beautiful, I think, about all of the work we did for this opening sort of essay or table setting for this panel that we were going to do was in To Kill a Mockingbird. Harper Lee said, people generally see what they look for and hear what they listen for. And Charles knew his audience. All he had to do was say, in Mission Hill, it was a black man. And under the auspices of doing good, and that's often what happens, law enforcement, including the office I now lead, jumped to a million conclusions. And there was a community that was invaded as a result of that. I need you to hear that there's a lot of hurt still 30 years later from not just the Bennett family and the Swanson families, but the Mission Hill community. There were grown men that were almost in tears when they recounted at our panel the way they were treated by law enforcement, the brutality, the violence, the hatred, all under the auspices of doing good. And then, as usual with certain communities, no apology afterwards. We've seen recently how hard it is for law enforcement to make an apology when we know what they did was wrong. I'm really excited about the fact that in this role I get to say, certainly to the Bennett family, we're sorry.
Well, and our guest is Suffolk DA Rachel Rollins. If the DA's office was complicit, wasn't all of Boston complicit? Why single out the DA's office?
Because that's where I work, right? So
you're making amends for the place you represent.
That's exactly right.
But is it, you know, weren't we all sort of just caught up in this? Was there malicious intent here when we...
I believe
Charles Stewart. Yeah.
I think people, you know, part of what I talked about was the fact that this was an all-American couple, right? There were calls. I pulled all the articles and read everything. They called them, it was Camelot, right? They were a beautiful couple that apparently had everything. And he didn't fit the profile of a domestic abuser, and certainly not a murderer.
Even when I interviewed Carl DeMatey, I said to him that day on the street, I said, did you ever suspect Chuck? Did you ever see any indication that he was angry or physical towards Carol? And he looked at me and said, no.
Yeah.
I never did.
Yeah. Mm. And I don't want to miss the fact that the Bennett family was present on October 30th of this year when we had the event, and so was Carl DeMatey and his son, who's a law student right now, which is really exciting as well. But it was an incredibly powerful moment. I've had some powerful moments as the DA in my 10 months here. This by far took the cake.
Let me ask it this way. Newman Flanagan was where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
If you were there then, would you have done anything differently?
Well, I think personally we have the ability now of 30 years of seeing domestic violence, right? Mm-hmm. Even one of the panelists that we had was from Brigham and Women's Hospital, who dealt with trauma, domestic violence issues. They didn't even have a mechanism back then 30 years ago to ask people, do you feel safe in your home, right? Mm-hmm. And so much has changed now. I'm not here to vilify people for what they did. I'm only speaking facts, right? I've pulled the Charles Stewart file. I've reviewed things with my first assistant. I have, with my own eyes, seen the page after page after page after page after page of lists of black men that were questioned, that were, you know, strip searched in public.
Have we grown as a city? Would the same thing happen today?
That's a great question. I certainly hope not. I think, you know, with unfortunately the rise of domestic violence homicides, and we've had one in Suffolk County since I've taken office. I sat with a family today. We're waiting for a verdict in a domestic violence homicide out of Revere today. But I think we are better at getting people the help that they need, looking at every single possible person as being involved and not leaving any stones unturned. I think we took Charles's word for it, and Charles knew his audience. And, you know, I think he was a master manipulator and a coward. And, you know, I just am excited, though, that we started a really tough conversation, because it's not just about the Bennett family, the Swanson family, the DeMatey family, and Mission Hill. This is a scar. It's a brand on our city. We need to start rectifying what it is that happened. And until we start talking about things, that's never going to occur.
All right. Our guest is the Suffolk DA, Rachel Rollins. We've been talking, of course, about what happened 30 years ago, the Charles Stewart case that shocked Boston, and some of the lessons that have been learned. Maybe some haven't been learned. All right. We've been talking, among other things, about the Charles Stewart case, 30 years old this week or thereabouts. The DA convened a panel at Northeastern recently to talk about this and the problems that still exist racially and so forth in the city of Boston. D.A. Rollins, we're moving on. In March, this last March, out came the 65-page memo, nonviolent offenses. You want to handle drug, traffic, and property crimes like driving without a license or shoplifting, according to some reports. The memo includes data from the DA's office which shows that since 2013, 17 of the top 25 most frequently filed charges were categorized as nonviolent. To put it simply, D.A. Rollins, you're not there to make laws. You're overreaching. Who made you the king? Who made you the legislature? You know, if every DA in the country decided that we're going to do this and we're not going to do that, we'd have chaos.
First of all, it's Queen. But second of all, you know, look, we use our discretion every single day. Every day.
Well, this is not discretion. This is overturning the system.
It actually isn't. And what I would push back and say is police officers use discretion every day. If you've ever gotten a speeding ticket or been told, keep it, you know, slow down a little bit, that's them using their discretion. They're not elected. Judges use their discretion every day when they decide how much the bail is going to be, how much time people
within
are going to serve.
Within guidelines.
They don't necessarily have to follow those. If there are minimum mandatories, their hands are tied.
If they go too far out of bounds, they're going to get reprimanded. They're going to get punished somehow.
Not factually accurate. Someone would have to file a complaint against them.
Well,
but they use their discretion every day, and they're not elected. I was very clear about who I was going to be when I won. I told everyone in Suffolk County, I put it in writing as a candidate and said, in the first instance, with respect to these 15 types of crimes, none of which are serious or violent, I want to think about diversion first before we think about sending people to jail. Overwhelmingly, sir, these are my municipal and district court cases.
Mm-hmm.
These people have substance use disorder, mental health issue, food.
I don't disagree with any of that. I'm just saying there's a way to change the system, and then there's a way not to. It seems like you've gone about it, hey, I'm going to do it myself. It's going to be unilateral, and I'm not going to follow the rule of law.
Well,
your response.
I would say back, I'm following the rule of law every day. There are thousands of laws on the books that we don't prosecute. I was elected to use my discretion. And what I would push back is if you want to spend our time talking about trespasses and driving without a license when we have 1,367 unsolved homicides in Suffolk County, I want to bring you to a family's house that hasn't had a call from Boston police detectives from the homicide unit or my office, and they have a loved one that's been murdered, to say, you know what I'm going to do? Put all of my resources into non-violent, non-serious crimes and let you sit and linger for decades and not get any answer from us. That's outrageous. And I love saying to people, you don't like it, go to law school, run for office, and when you're DA, you have the authority and autonomy to do whatever it is that you want as well.
Mm.
The attorney general and DAs do not answer to necessarily...
Who do you answer to?
I answer to the voters of Suffolk County.
Okay.
And they overwhelmingly said, this is exactly what we want. So I was clear about who I would be.
Can I make one more point on that? And I'm wondering, you know, obviously you laid this out when you were running, so people knew full well, that's sure. Isn't it a bit of pandering to the voter, though? Hey, my cousin's going to get out of jail if I vote for Rachel.
I would never... I didn't run on that. Most of the people so first and foremost, shoplifting, you don't even look at jail until your third shoplifting charge. That isn't Rachel Rollins. That's what the penalties are for a shoplifting charge. So there are already baked into the system an understanding that there are certain crimes that even if you commit them and everyone agrees you did, you never go to jail for that. All I'm saying, sir, is my memo makes very clear, and I chose to bring a copy of it, even though I wrote it myself, that there are buckets of people. If you are someone who has a substance use disorder and have never shoplifted before in your life, I might null pros your case. You won't even go before a judge. We're going to ask you to get some treatment and say we could prosecute you next time. But if it's Joe, and this is the eighth time he's done it in the last 3 months,
yeah,
he's even if he does have a substance use disorder or mental health issues, all of the leniency and discretion we've tried to use, if it's not working, Joe goes right to arraignment, and then probation gets to deal with him with the judge. And we will be with our partners doing this. But what I can tell you, sir, the system isn't working right now. We have a 67% recidivism rate on these 15 types of crimes, meaning that when we do actually prosecute them, send them away, $55,000 a year to send them to Nashua Street, taxpayer dollars, $55,000 a year. I'd rather have them go to the Gavin House and get well and get treatment and no longer be substance use dependent, get their mental health issues dealt with, and then I never see them again unless they want to come back and work for me and start changing the system from the inside.
Rachel, one of the things that you said, though, when you were running, and you put it up on your website, that you were not going to be prosecuting certain crimes. You said that if you did that, you'd be saving money, you'd be freeing up resources to focus on other areas. Here you are 10 months in. What can you point to right now and say, okay, that would not have gotten done unless I had done this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we fundamentally changed who we are as an office, right? I was told we needed 30 new assistant district attorneys. I said, you get 21. And we're hiring a licensed clinical social worker. We're hiring data analysts and technologists, nerds, right, that can help us do all of our data that could explain it to me and make sure all of our systems work. We're hiring people with a public health background, public policy background. We are looking at a problem holistically, not just as lawyers. Lawyers are really good at prosecuting cases. And let me be very clear, if you are violent, if you are engaged in sexual assaults, rapes, kidnappings, shootings, assault and batteries, this is the last face you want to see as the district attorney. I am holding you accountable. I am looking at your family and saying he or she will be treated with dignity and respect in the process. You will be fully explained. It will be fully explained to you what is going to happen. But we are removing them from the community because Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, Jamaica Plain, Chelsea, Revere, we deserve to be safe too, just like all the W towns, Winchester, Waubon, Wellesley, you know, they get to go out and check their mail and let their kids play in the street. We deserve that as well. And if people are violent, we're removing you. But I just don't think that our jails and prisons should be filled with people that are nonviolent, that have mental health issues. Our prisons are our new asylums, right? Yeah. We don't need to do that anymore. I want to get people treatment.
All right. We're talking with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. She's live in our studio. She's nice enough to join us for the hour. She's going to stay right there in the chair. Continuing now our conversation with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. We invited her here today to talk about the 30th anniversary of the murder of Carol Stewart, a murder which really shook the city of Boston and left racial scars even till today. We also just talked about where she made headlines when she was running and her decision not to prosecute some low-level crimes. But I think that the real issue everybody really wants to hear about, Rachel, and it's front and center for me, is babysitting Ed Markey's nephews and nieces. And I understand that he not only did you babysit Ed Markey's nephews and nieces, that you've now endorsed him as well.
I have. So when I was younger, Senator Markey's brother and then wife lived in Winchester, and they were dear friends with my parents. His nieces and nephews, Megan, Morgan, and Garen, I used to babysit all the time. So I was a fan well before any of you guys knew who this wonderful man was. He also supported me when I ran and was helpful. I've seen the work that he's done, and I'm loyal, right? Okay. So, you know, it was really not a hard choice for me. But, yes, I've endorsed Senator Markey.
A lot of Democrats stood on the sidelines there, so I did want to mention that. But also, you made headlines last week. I believe it was last week, if not that, it was the week before. Your decision to charge a Boston College student with involuntary manslaughter in connection with the suicide death of her boyfriend. The 21-year-old In Young Yu was indicted by a grand jury on October 18th. Alexander Ertola, 22, leapt to his death from a Roxbury parking garage this past May, just hours before he was to graduate from Boston College. Tell us about your decision to bring involuntary manslaughter charges there. Why is that appropriate?
It's appropriate. You know, on October 28th, we actually announced that indictment, and it was unsealed because the behavior we feel strongly was criminal. And we've seen in Massachusetts with Michelle Carter, we've seen with Conrad's bill currently pending in the legislature, that we haven't adapted yet to what is happening in society with social media, with different mechanisms by which you can engage with each other. I think what's really
interesting... She's out of the country, isn't she?
She's currently out of the country.
Any luck getting her back?
We are cautiously optimistic that she will be returning, and we'll be letting the media know when that's going to happen and when an arraignment will occur. But I think this is important, sort of tying back to the Carol DeMatey situation. Domestic violence looks different than a lot of when we grew up, what we thought it looked like, right? Carol DeMatey was a middle to upper class person. She was a lawyer. They were a good-looking, upstanding family. That wasn't what we believed. With Michelle Carter and her then, you know, boyfriend, even though they had not really spent much time together, you had to read that many, many times to say, wait a minute, is it the girlfriend that did this and not the boyfriend? Now we're seeing it does not necessarily matter who the dominant party is, who the perpetrator is. And what's really important for us to talk about with respect to domestic violence is it's not necessarily all physical violence. If your significant other or partner is making you give them your paycheck, if they are isolating you from your family and friends, we want you to know that the DA's office doesn't necessarily prosecute all of those cases, but you can call us and we can get you treatment and help. With respect to In Young Yoo, though, we believe that the behavior crossed into criminal. And
how so?
Well, there were thousands and thousands of texts essentially telling her partner, her boyfriend, to kill himself and that he was.
If she had only sent 10 texts, it would have made a difference.
That's really a great question, Joe. I think when you look at Michelle Carter, we had egregious, horrific behavior telling somebody in just a few texts, get back in there and do it. You know, I'm paraphrasing. I don't have
well,
it
listen,
in front of
me. Well, listen, you know, D.A., I just flat out disagree with you.
Yeah, I understand. I love that. You seem to like doing that. I'm all over it. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
We don't have enough time,
no,
but
I'm
let's
joking.
Try it. Now, the younger kids, right, the teenage one, in the end, this act, which is horrific, suicide, is an act one does to oneself. So where, I mean, what I don't understand in this picture I'm getting of you is that on one hand, you're letting these people out, the kind-hearted DA, and on the other hand, this person pushed this person into this horrific act, so we're going to clamp down on them. I can't wrap my mind around this. I don't see the logic there. I mean, this is, you know, get the guy, if there was domestic violence, of course, if there was... You know, some harm done there. But when you're talking about the psychological stuff, most of the time, you know this better than I do. These people in these relationships, both are very troubled, it would seem to me.
Yeah.
So you're blaming one for what the other did. Makes no sense.
Yeah. So what's your answer with respect to the Michelle Carter verdict? You disagree with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. All right. So now there's a law because it makes everybody feel good. And I imagine that's part of what the motivation is on the Suffolk DA's office. Am I wrong?
No,
it's just,
my motivation
it's responding to public pressure.
No, I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I think we have looked at the situation, and it was just really egregious. And my job is not—it's not about guilty, and it's not about getting guilties. It's about doing what's right.
Yeah, and you say it was egregious, but Joe used the word, 10 versus 1,000 text. And you said, well, that's a very good question. How capricious is that? And why would you run the DA's office like that?
Well, I run the DA's office by having really smart people around me that are looking at the matters they're dealing with and determining whether or not they think that these are crimes that we should be prosecuting.
Yeah.
And I believe that this is a case where the conduct, some 47,000 texts in a 2-month period from his partner, essentially beating him down, knowing the psychological state that she had put him in and continuing to engage in the behavior. I think it's the opposite of Michelle Carter, right? Michelle Carter, we had a not very physical relationship in the beginning, and then some really egregious but very small number of texts saying, get back in there and
do
it.
Did you agree with that one?
So I didn't make the charging decision in Michelle Carter.
What would you have done?
That's a good question. Yeah. I support the prosecution of Michelle Carter. I think I do believe, sir, that words matter, and I do believe that you can drive people to do things if you are taking advantage of them. So I stand by the decision, but ultimately a jury, not a grand jury, a jury is going to make a determination here.
Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us for this 5 o'clock hour on Bloomberg Bay State Business. And I hope that, you know, despite Tom's behavior, that you'll come back. You know, I mean, it just, you know, we all apologize.
I love Tom's behavior.
No. And that's what I love about it. And I love that the give and take. And it was a great conversation, really, seriously.
All right. Tomorrow on our program, two West Roxbury businessmen will be here to tell us why the city is putting a bike lane right down Center Street and why this is going to damage their business and why the city should cease and desist. I'm Tom Maroney with Joe Shortsleeve and Kim Kerrigan. It's Bloomberg, Bay State Business, 106.1 Boston, Newburyport, and 92.9 HD2.